Escape Pod 55, May 25th, 2006. Today's story, Down Memory Lane, by Mike Krznick.
Hello, and welcome to Escape Pod. I'm Steve Ely. So, Worldcon. This is the shorthand name for the World Science Fiction Convention, which is the longest-running SF convention in the world. It started in 1939, and except for World War II, it's been held every year since. The thing that makes Worldcon different from almost every other convention is that it changes locations. Fan groups in different cities create bids, host parties, and put out information about why their city is the best choice for a given year. And at each Worldcon, the members get to vote on the location a couple of years forward. There are rules that each year it can't be within a few hundred miles of the year before. So last year it was in Scotland, this year it's in Los Angeles, and next year it's going to be in Yokohama, Japan, which I'm really looking forward to. Activities include the Hugo Awards, which I mentioned before, and a costume masquerade that has to be seen to be believed, and lots of gaming and videos and panels and parties and signings and celebrations of SF, especially, though not exclusively, the written word. The convention side of science fiction is something a lot of people don't get into, and I can see why. The first couple of conventions I went to were so big and busy, and everyone seemed to know each other except for me. I went because I'd heard, this is how you meet people in the industry. But once I was there, I had no idea what to say to those industry people, and I felt more alienated than fun. What changed that was meeting some people on the internet, aspiring writers like me, and forming a circle of friends who, because we were so spread out, really only get to see each other at Worldcon. And now, because of those friends, I get it. All of the events, the panels and awards and things, are entertaining and sometimes informative, but the real joy is the other people. It's like going to a baseball game. You don't have to go to enjoy the sport. You can watch it at home just fine. But a lot of people go because it's a chance to spend time with friends or family, with the entertainment already lined up. Conventions are SF's ballgame, and in that sense, Worldcon is, well, the World Series. I'm definitely going to be there this year, and if you decide to go, I'm hoping you'll track me down and say hi. And to make that easier, well, this isn't totally approved from the Worldcon staff yet, but this is still the right intro to announce it. Ivo Terra from Patio Books and I are working together to reserve and organize a party suite. We're talking about a couple of nights of parties celebrating podcasts and podcast listeners. And if that sounds like fun to you, I hope to see you there. If things fall through for an official party suite, we'll figure out something just as cool off-site, because I want to see this happen. Worldcon is August 23rd through 27th at the Anaheim Convention Center in California. There'll be a link in the show notes, and it'll be a time to remember. With that, we introduce our third story in this year's Hugo nominee series, a poignant piece called Down Memory Lane by Mike Krznick. Mr. Krznick is a legend in science fiction, with more than 80 genre books and over 150 short stories to his name. His Kieran Yaga series of shorts has received more award nominations than any other story series in the genre. He's won the Hugo Award 5 times, the Nebula once, and has been nominated about 40 times between them. He's also one of the leading anthology editors today, making him a real champion of short fiction. He and his wife live in Cincinnati when they're not on safari in Africa, which they seem to be more often than not. The story is read for us by Alex Wilson, the mind and voice behind Telltale Weekly, a non-profit project to build a library of free audiobooks. If you're looking for only the best works to listen to, old or new, you should swing by telltaleweekly.org and see how you can support them and entertain yourself at the same time. And remember, it's story time.
Down Memory Lane by Mike Krznick. Gwendolyn sticks a finger into her cake, pulls it out and licks it with a happy smile on her face. "I like birthdays," she says, giggling with delight. I lean over and wipe some frosting off her chin. "Try to be a little neater," I say. "You wouldn't want to have to take a bath before you open your present." "Present?" she repeats excitedly, her gaze falling on the box with the colorful wrapping paper and the big satin bow. "Is it time for my present now, is it?" "Yes, it is," I answer. I pick up the box and hand it to her. "Happy birthday, Gwendolyn." She tears off the paper, shoves the card aside, and opens the box. An instant later, she emits a happy squeal and pulls out the rag doll. "This is my very favorite day of my whole life," she announces. I sigh and try to hold back my tears. Gwendolyn is 82 years old. She has been my wife for the last 60 of them. I don't know where I was when Kennedy was shot. I don't know what I was doing when the World Trade Center collapsed under the onslaught of two jetliners, but I remember every single detail, every minute, every second of the day we got the bad news. "It may not be Alzheimer's," said Dr. Castleman. "Alzheimer's is becoming a catchword for a variety of senile dementias. Eventually, we'll find out exactly which dementia it is, but there's no question that Gwendolyn is suffering from one of them." It wasn't a surprise. After all, we knew something was wrong. That's why she was being examined, but it was still a shock. "Is there any chance of curing it?" I asked, trying to keep my composure. He shook his head sadly. "Right now, we're barely able to slow it down." "How long have I got?" said Gwendolyn, her face grim, her jaw set.
"Physically, you're in great shape," said Castleman. "You could live another 10 to 20 years.
"How long before I don't know who anyone is?" she persisted. He shrugged helplessly.
"It proceeds at different rates with different people. At first, you won't notice any diminution, but before long, it will become noticeable, perhaps not to you, but to those around you, and it doesn't progress in a straight line. One day, you'll find you've lost the ability to read, and then, perhaps 2 months later, you'll see a newspaper headline or perhaps a menu in a restaurant, and you'll read it as easily as you do today. Paul here will be elated and think you're regaining your capacity, and he'll call me and tell me about it, but it won't last. In another day, another hour, another week, the ability will be gone again."
"Will I know what's happening to me?"
"That's almost the only good part of it," replied Castleman. "You know what lies ahead of you, but as it progresses, you will be less and less aware of any loss of your cognitive abilities. You'll be understandably bitter at the start and will put you on antidepressants, but the day will come when you no longer need them because you no longer remember that you ever had a greater mental capacity than you possess at that moment." She turned to me.
"I'm sorry, Paul." "It's not your fault," I said. "I'm sorry that you'll have to watch this happen to me." "There must be something we can do, some way we can fight it," I muttered.
"I'm afraid there isn't," said Castleman. "They say there are stages you go through when you know you're going to die: disbelief, then anger, then self-pity, and finally acceptance. No one's ever come up with a similar list for the dementias, but in the end, what you're going to have to do is accept it and learn to live with it."
"How long before I have to go to wherever I have to go when Paul can't care for me alone?" Castleman took a deep breath, let it out, and pursed his lips.
"It varies. It could be 5 or 6 months. It could be 2 years. It could be longer. A lot depends on you."
"On me?" said Gwendolyn.
"As you become more childlike, you will become more curious about things that you no longer know or recognize. Paul tells me you've always had a probing mind. Will you be content to sit in front of the television while he's sleeping or otherwise occupied, or will you feel a need to walk outside and then forget how to get back home? Will you be curious about all the buttons and switches on the kitchen appliances? 2-year-olds can't open doors or reach kitchen counters, but you will be able to, so, as I say, it depends on you, and that is something no one can predict."
He paused. "And there may be rages."
"Rages?" I repeated.
"In more than half the cases," he replied. "She won't know why she's so enraged. You will, of course, but you won't be able to do anything about it. If it happens, we have medications that will help."
I was so depressed, I was thinking of suicide pacts, but Gwendolyn turned to me and said, "Well, Paul, it looks like we have a lot of living to cram into the next few months. I've always wanted to take a Caribbean cruise. We'll stop at the travel agency on the way home." That was her reaction to the most horrific news a human being can receive. I thanked God that I'd had 60 years with her, and I cursed him for taking away everything that made her the woman I loved before we'd said and done all the things we had wanted to say and do. She'd been beautiful once. She still was. Physical beauty fades, but inner beauty never does. For 60 years we had lived together, loved together, worked together, played together. We got to where we could finish each other's sentences, where we knew each other's tastes better than we knew our own. We had fights, who doesn't, but we never once went to bed mad at each other. We raised 3 children, 2 sons and a daughter. 1 son was killed in Vietnam. The other son and the daughter kept in touch as best they could, but they had their own lives to lead, and they lived many states away. Gradually, our outside contacts became fewer and fewer. We were all each other needed. And now, I was going to watch the only thing I'd ever truly loved become a little less each day, until there was nothing left but an empty shell. The cruise went well. We even took the train all the way to the rum factory at the center of Jamaica, and we spent a few days in Miami before flying home. She seemed so normal, so absolutely herself, that I began thinking that maybe Dr. Castleman's diagnosis had been mistaken. But then it began. There was no single incident that couldn't have occurred 50 years ago, nothing that you couldn't find a reasonable excuse for, but things kept happening. One afternoon she put a roast in the oven, and at dinner time we found that she'd forgotten to turn the oven on. 2 days later we were watching the Maltese Falcon for the umpteenth time, and suddenly she couldn't remember who killed Humphrey Bogart's partner. She discovered Raymond Chandler, an author she'd loved for years. There were no rages, but there was everything else Dr. Castleman had predicted. I began counting her pills. She was on 5 different medications, 3 of them twice a day. She never skipped them all, but somehow the numbers never came out quite right. I'd mention a person, a place, an incident, something we'd shared together, and 1 time out of 3 she couldn't recall it, and she'd get annoyed when I'd explain that she had forgotten it. In a month, it became 2 out of 3 times. Then she lost interest in reading. She blamed it on her glasses, but when I took her to get a new prescription, the optometrist tested her and told her that her vision hadn't changed since her last visit 2 years earlier. She kept fighting it, trying to stimulate her brain with crossword puzzles, math problems, anything that would cause her to think. But each month, the puzzles and problems got a little simpler, and each month she solved a few less than she had the month before. She still loved music, and she still loved leaving seeds out for the birds and watching them come by to feed. But she could no longer hum along with the melodies or identify the birds. She had never allowed me to keep a gun in the house. It was better, she said, to let thieves steal everything than to get killed in a shootout. They were just possessions, we were all that counted. And I honored her wishes for 60 years. But now I went out and bought a small handgun and a box of bullets, and kept them locked in my desk against the day that she was so far gone she no longer knew who I was. I told myself that when that day occurred, I would put a bullet into her head and another into my own. But I knew that I couldn't. Myself, yes, the woman who'd been my life. Never. I met her in college. She was an honor student. I was a not very successful jock, third string defensive end in football, backup power forward in basketball, big, strong, and dumb, but she saw something in me. I'd noticed her around the campus. She was too good-looking not to notice, but she hung out with the brains, and our paths almost never crossed. The only reason I asked her out the first time was because one of my frat brothers bet me $10 she wouldn't give me the time of day. But for some reason I'll never know, she said yes, and for the next 60 years I was never willingly out of her presence. When we had money, we spent it, and when we didn't have money, we were every bit as happy. We just didn't live as well or travel as much. We raised our kids, sent them out into the world, watched one die and two move away to begin their own lives, and wound up the way we'd started, just the two of us. And now, one of us was vanishing, day by day, minute by minute. One morning, she locked the bathroom door and couldn't remember how to unlock it. She was so panicky that she couldn't hear me giving instructions from the other side. I was on the phone calling the fire department when she appeared at my side to ask why I was talking to them and what was burning. She had no memory of locking herself in, I explained to Dr. Castleman the next day. One moment she couldn't cope with a lock any 3-year-old could manipulate, and the next moment she opened the door and didn't remember having any problem with it.
That's the way these things progress, he said.
How long before she doesn't know me anymore? Castleman sighed.
I really don't know, Paul. You've been the most important thing in her life, the most constant thing, so it stands to reason that you'll be the last thing she forgets.
He sighed again.
It could be a few months, a few years, or it could be tomorrow.
It's not fair, I muttered.
Nobody ever said it was, he replied. I had her checked over while she was here, and for what it's worth, she's in excellent physical health for a woman of her age. Heart and lungs are fine, blood pressure's normal.
Of course her blood pressure was normal, I thought bitterly. She didn't spend most of her waking hours wondering what it would be like when the person she had spent her life with no longer recognized her. Then I realized that she didn't spend most of her waking hours thinking of anything, and I felt guilty for pitying myself when she was the one whose mind and memories were racing away at an ever faster rate. 2 weeks later, we went shopping for groceries. She wandered off to get something, ice cream, I think, and when I'd picked up what I needed and went over to the frozen food section, she wasn't there. I looked around, checked out the next few aisles, no luck. I asked one of the stock girls to check the woman's restroom. It was empty. I started getting a panicky feeling in the pit of my stomach. I was just about to go out into the parking lot to look for her when a cop brought her into the store, leading her very gently by the arm. She was wandering around looking for her car, he explained. A 1961 Nash Rambler. We haven't owned that car in 40 years or more, I said. I turned to Gwendolyn. Are you all right? Her face was streaked by tears. I'm sorry, she said. I couldn't remember where we parked the car. It's all right, I said. She kept crying and telling me how sorry she was. Pretty soon, everyone was staring, and the store manager asked if I'd like to take her to his office and let her sit down. I thanked him and the cop, but decided she'd be better off at home, so I led her out to the Ford we'd owned for the past 5 years and drove her home. As we pulled into the garage and got out of the car, she stood back and looked at it. What a pretty car, she said. Whose is it?
They're not sure of anything, said Dr. Castleman. But they think it's got something to do with the amyloid beta protein. An abundance of it can usually be found in people suffering from Alzheimer's or Down syndrome.
Can't you take it out or do something to neutralize it? I asked. Gwendolyn sat in a chair staring at the wall. We could have been 10,000 miles away as far as she was concerned.
If it was that simple, they'd have done it.
So, it's a protein, I said. Does it come in some kind of food? Is there something she shouldn't be eating?
He shook his head. There are all kinds of proteins. This is one you're born with.
Is it in the brain?
Initially, it's in the spinal fluid.
Well, can't you drain it out? I persisted.
He sighed. By the time we know it's a problem in a particular individual, it's too late. It forms plaques on the brain, and once that happens, the disease is irreversible.
He paused wearily.
At least it's irreversible today. Someday they'll cure it. They should be able to slow it down before too long. I wouldn't be surprised to see it eradicated within a quarter of a century. There may even come a day when they can test embryos for an amyloid beta imbalance and correct it in utero. They're making progress.
But not in time to help Gwendolyn.
No, not in time to help Gwendolyn.
Gradually, over the next few months, she became totally unaware that she even had Alzheimer's. She no longer read, but she watched the television incessantly. She especially liked children's shows and cartoons. I would come into the room and hear the 82-year-old woman I loved singing along with the Mickey Mouse Club. I had a feeling that if they still ran test patterns, she could watch one for hours on end. And then came the morning I had known would come. I was fixing her breakfast, some cereal she'd seen advertised on television, and she looked up at me, and I could tell that she no longer knew who I was. Oh, she wasn't afraid of me or even curious, but there was absolutely no spark of recognition. The next day I moved her into a home that specializes in the senile dementias.
I'm sorry, Paul, said Dr. Castleman, but it really is for the best. She needs professional care. You've lost weight, you're not getting any sleep, and to be blunt, it no longer makes any difference to her who feeds and cleans and medicates her.
Well, it makes a difference to me, I said angrily. They treat her like an infant.
That's what she's become.
She's been there 2 weeks, and I haven't seen them really try to communicate with her.
She has nothing to say, Paul.
It's there, I said. It's somewhere inside her brain.
Her brain isn't what it once was, said Castleman. You have to face up to that.
I took her there too soon, I said. There must be a way to connect with her.
You're an adult. And despite her appearance, she's a 4-year-old child, said Castleman gently. You no longer have anything in common.
We have a lifetime in common, I snapped.
I couldn't listen to it anymore, so I got up and stalked out of his office. I decided that depending on Dr. Castleman was a dead end, and I began visiting other specialists. They all told me pretty much the same thing. One of them even showed me his lab, where they were doing all kinds of chemical experiments on the amyloid protein and a number of other things. It was encouraging, but nothing was going to happen fast enough to cure Gwendolyn. 2 or 3 times each day, I picked up that pistol I'd bought and toyed with ending it. But I kept thinking, what if there's a miracle, medical, religious, whatever kind? What if she becomes Gwendolyn again? She'll be all alone with a bunch of senile old men and women, and I'll have deserted her. So I couldn't kill myself, and I couldn't help her, and I couldn't just stand by and watch her. Somehow, somewhere, there had to be a way to connect with her, to communicate on the same level again. We'd faced some pretty terrible problems together. Losing a son, suffering a miscarriage, watching each of our parents die in turn. And as long as we were together, we were able to overcome them. This was just one more problem, and every problem is capable of a solution. I found the solution, too. It wasn't where I expected, and it certainly wasn't what I expected, but she was 82 years old and sinking fast, and I didn't hesitate. That's where things stand this evening. Earlier today, I bought this notebook, and this marks the end of my first entry. Friday, June 22nd. I'd heard about the clinic while I was learning everything I could about the disease. The government outlawed it and shut it down, so they moved it lock, stock, and barrel to Guatemala. It wasn't much to look at, but then I wasn't expecting much. Just a miracle of a different sort. They make no bones about what they anticipate if the experiment goes as planned. That's why they only accept terminal patients. And because they have so few and are so desperate for volunteers, that's also why they didn't challenge me when I told them I had a slow-acting cancer. I signed a release that probably wouldn't hold up in any court of law outside Guatemala. They now have my permission to do just about anything they want to me. Saturday, June 23rd. So it begins. I thought they had injected into my spine, but instead they went through the carotid artery in my neck. Makes sense, it's the conduit between the spine and the brain. If anything's going to get the protein where it can do its work, that's the ticket. I thought it would hurt like hell, but it's just a little sore. Except for that, I don't feel any different. Wednesday, June 27th. Fourth day in a row of tedious lectures explaining how some of us will die, but a few may be saved and all humanity will benefit or something like that. Now I have an inkling of how lab rats and guinea pigs feel. They're not aware that they're dying. And I guess before too long we won't be either. Wednesday, July 3rd. After a week of having me play with the most idiotic puzzles, they tell me that I've lost 6% of my cognitive functions and that the condition is accelerating. It seems to please them no end. I'm not convinced. I think if they'd given me a little more time, I'd do better on these damn tests. I mean, it's been a long time since I was in school. I'm out of practice. Sunday, July 7th. You know, I think it's working. I was reading down in the lounge, and for the longest time I couldn't remember where my room was. Good. The faster it works, the better. I've got a lot of catching up to do. Tuesday, July 16th. Today we got another talking to. They say the shots are stronger and the symptoms are appearing even faster than they'd hoped, and it's almost time to try the anecdote. Anecdote, is that the right word? Friday, July 26th. Boy, am I lucky. At the last minute, I remembered why I went there in the first place. I waited until it was dark and snuck out. When I got to the airport, I didn't have any money, but they asked to see my wallet and took out this plastic card and did something with it and said it was okay and gave me a ticket. Saturday, July 27. I wrote down my address so I wouldn't forget. And boy, am I lucky I did, because when I got a cab at the airport, I couldn't remember what to tell him. We drove, and finally I remembered I had wrote it down. But when we got home, I didn't have a key. I started pounding on the door, but no one was there to let me in. And finally they came with a loud siren and took me somewhere else. I can't stay long. I have to find Gwendolyn before it is too late, but I can't remember what it would be too late for. Monday, August. He says his name is Dr. Castleman, and that I know him. And he kept saying, "Oh, Paul, why did you do this to yourself?" And I told him I didn't remember, but I know I had a reason, and it had something to do with Gwendolyn. "Do you remember her?" he said. "Of course I do," I said. "She is the love of my life." I asked when I can see her, and he said, "Soon." Wednesday. They gave me my own room, but I don't want my own room. I want to be with Gwendolyn. Finally, they let me see her, and she was as beautiful as ever, and I wanted to hug her and kiss her, and when I walked up to her, she started crying, and the nurse took her away. It has been 8 days since I wrote here, or maybe 9, I keep forgetting to. Today I saw a pretty little girl in the hall with pretty white hair. She reminds me of someone, but I don't know who. Tomorrow, if I remember, I will bring her a present. I saw the pretty girl again today. I took a flower from a pot and gave it to her, and she smiled and said thank you, and we talked a lot. And she said, I am so glad we met, and I'm finally happy. I said, so am I. I think we are going to be great friends because we like each other and have so much in common. I asked her name, and she couldn't remember, so I will call her Gwendolyn. I think I knew someone called Gwendolyn once, a long time ago, and it is a very pretty name for a very pretty new friend.
This recording was produced by Telltale Weekly for Escape Pod.
And that was our story. I've read and listened to it a few times now, and I keep changing my mind about that ending. A couple of public service announcements here. The first one is for Alex Wilson, who read the story you just listened to. He's doing a fundraiser to benefit the Clarion Foundation, which supports the annual Clarion Workshop. From his Telltale Weekly site, he's selling 5 Edgar Allan Poe stories for $5, and matching that with his own donation to the foundation for anyone who buys. I think this is a great deal, and he does great readings of the stories. The link is in the show notes. And another, long but fun, promo for someone else I'm a fan of.
Hello, my name is fictional athlete Bobnit Tivol, and I'd like to speak to you today on behalf of the Hooting Yard Benevolent Fund for distressed out-of-print pamphleteers. I don't know about you, but often as I go about my day, waiting for a bus, say, or roaming in the hills and getting my socks snagged in a thicket of brambles, or sheltering in a kiosk from a thunderous downpour, I find my thoughts turning to out-of-print pamphleteers. You know, those poor bewildered wreckages of humanity, snivelling in their rags, covered in pustules and boils and running sores, with whole colonies of flies whirling around their heads, those wretched figures whose pamphlets were once in print. Now they're reduced to destitution, sprawled hopelessly with their spindly legs dangling in the water of some pond in the middle of a field, watched over by sinister cows, but forgotten by those who once read their printed pamphlets with a mixture of glee, excitement, and drooling. They may even have danced to the text of a pamphlet in a seaside disco out at the end of the pier before jumping into the sea and flailing around, waterlogged but happy. Ah, but for the out-of-print pamphleteer, such a joyous readership has long since disappeared. And that's where the Hooting Yard Benevolent Fund for Distressed Out-of-Print Pamphleteers steps in to help. On this occasion, we're pleased to announce an exciting auction. We have one copy of the exceedingly rare paperback book Twitching and Shattered, a 136-page compilation of work by Frank Key, originally published as long ago as 1989. Here you will find over a dozen texts, including By Aerostat to Hooting Yard, The Churn in the Muck, and A Zest for Crumpled Things, together with many fine illustrations, scribbled drawings, and old photographs, including a big A3 fold-out diagram and a piece of real sandpaper. Mr. Key has personally authorised the sale of this rarity by auction and will sign and dedicate the book to the successful bidder. If you would like to get your grubby paws on this magnificent item, please go to http://podcasts.resonancefm.com for further details. Thank you for listening to this appeal on behalf of the Hooting Yard Benevolent Fund for Distressed Out-of-Print Pamphleteers.
I've been a fan of Frank Key and the Hooting Yard podcast for quite a while now. He has read a piece for Escape Pod, and his work is surreal but brilliant. This is a one-time auction to help him out, and the book does sound cool. There's a link to the eBay item in the show notes. It runs for a few more days. Right now, I'm the high bidder, but maybe you can top me for the sake of Hooting Yard. Not too much on show feedback this week. There were a couple of people confused by my mention of our review from Shelley the Republican last time, and I got some more information about it myself after the show. There are actually two Shelleys the Republican. There was a Shelley the Republican podcast, which seems to have faded, but was a sincere, genuine neoconservative point of view. The Shelley the Republican blog, the one that reviewed us, is still active and is a parody of Shelley by some people in Germany and the UK. I think they kept the same name to maximize confusion, and it seems to have worked. So if you were a loyal listener of Shelley's podcast and feel shocked that it was satire, well, that one wasn't. Am I making sense yet? A final reminder that I'm going to be at Balticon this weekend. Right now, I'm scheduled to do panels on podcasts we love, podcast basics, advanced podcasting structure, podcasting fiction as a marketing tool, sci-fi podcasts, Ask the Editors, and the Lancelot Biggs radio play. Yes, I'm crazy, but I wouldn't wish for anything less. If you're going to be there, I hope you'll stop by and say hi. Again, that's this weekend in Baltimore. Escape Pod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated. This story is on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and is therefore legal for copying, public performance, propaganda, or burning onto Razor Edge CDs for deadly ninja duels. But not alteration or making huge piles of money from it. Those rights are reserved by our authors. Our music is by Daikaiju, bringing you the best surf rock music for deadly ninja duels. 4 out of 5 ninjas agree, and the 5th one is dead. You can acquire skills by going to daikaiju.org. That was our show for this week. We'll be back next Thursday with another fine Hugo nominee. I'll close with a great pearl of wisdom from a movie I just saw again tonight, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. He teaches us, hey, don't be mean. We don't have to be mean because, remember, no matter where you go, there you are. We'll see you next week, and have fun.